Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Ladies and gentlemen, today is the 15th of the 8th month, 2025, and it is a Friday evening, and we are doing the most. Ladies and gentlemen, this is officially the end of our conversation around emotionally supporting our spouses and those that are around us. The reason that we are having this conversation is because I believe that we as people have a tendency of not really looking after one another and not really being able and capable of withstanding each other's hurt, withstanding each other's pain, and also sitting in the hard times. Sitting in the hard times is gruesome. Sitting in the hard times is gnarly. It's not pretty. It is unorthodox. It is not exactly what you want, because it's not as nice as having fun moments and, oh yay, loving on each other and, oh yay, yeah, we're having a good time and, oh yay, 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 yay. It is definitely not any of that. But what happens, right, when we are going through such tough times and we don't know how to mask it any longer? And when we don't know how to mask it any longer, we just kind of just be there. Eh? What happens when that is the ordeal? So, ladies and gentlemen, we talked about active listening. We talked about what it is when we talk about emotionally comforting our spouses. And we talked about how to emotionally support our spouses from a different perspective, a cultural perspective, where we are not really raised to be up and about into each other's emotions and feelings and stuff like that. But at some point we have to acknowledge and understand that we are spending a lifetime together. So we might as well learn the ins and the outs of this life thing. I think we've mastered what it means to emotionally support, financially support one another, because, when a woman is in love, when a woman is in love, she spends money. So I don't think that there's a married man out there that has ever had financial difficulties and his go-to person was not his spouse. And I don't believe that there's anybody in a committed relationship where they had an issue that was financial and their partner didn't make a plan. So we talked about active listening. We talked about validation. We talked about empathy. And then now we are moving on. We are moving on to encouraging communication. I think that many of us skip the two steps. We skip the first four steps and then we just move to encouraging communication, because I mean, most of us say things like, ah, don't worry, it's going to get better. And don't worry that there are many fish in the sea. And so we saw that girl was not all that. And we've got so much to say when it comes to us and our spouses. So let's summarize. So it's active listening, paying close attention and stopping everything that you're doing to pay attention to what the person is talking about. We also spoke about the fact that we are always anticipating when we're talking about real talk and we're talking about serious talk, we're always anticipating the conversation to go in a certain way. We're anticipating the person to be talking to us like in a sad cartoon, which I just don't know what to say with my life matriarch, and oh my goodness, I'm so sad. And that is what we are expecting when we say that somebody's in turmoil or they are in distress. We are expecting them to sound like, look like, be like. And then we find a happy-go-lucky somebody that is somewhere, somehow still smiling through the pain. And we assume that they like to joke. We assume that they are not serious. But what that does to an individual is it makes them feel like their vulnerability was not seen. It makes them feel as if they were not taken seriously. I remember there's a lady in my vicinity or in my previous vicinity, right? And she's from my village. And, usually she asks, you know, how are you doing? And, you know, just pleasantries. We exchange pleasantries, but, I would think that she would want to become a friend, but, I don't have time for friendship right now. I don't have time for new friends. Because even the ones that I'm having, I'm struggling to maintain those friendships. So what would a new friendship cost me? So, and then one day she asked me something and I gave her an honest answer. I gave her an honest answer when we were going through our difficult times, with the man. She asked me where he was and I told her the truth. I said that no, at the moment I'm just taking a breather from this. I'm taking a breather and I'm kind of just, you know, backing away to see how things are going to play out, and I'm not putting any more effort into it. And you know me, so I'm all honest about this. And because of who I am and because of the happy-go-lucky person that I am, or the jolly kind of person, because the thing is that I find humor in many things. And if something is funny, just because I'm sad doesn't mean I'm not going to laugh at that funny thing. It doesn't mean that I'm not sad anymore just because I laughed that once or those 10 times. You know, it doesn't mean that I'm not sad. I can laugh the whole day and I'll still be sad. You know, I'll be sad about the situation in itself, but not about my entire life. You understand? Because I have a lot to be grateful for. I have a lot of answered prayers. I have a lot of blessings. I have you guys. I have so much, you know. I'm walking in abundance. So just because something, there's a section within my life that's not going okay, doesn't mean that I'm going to look at the world as if it's a gloomy place. Yes, occasionally, I'm going to daze off and look into the horizon and think about my dilemma. But it's not going to be a constant thing, especially if you are also hilarious and you are also hella funny and you're bringing the cheese, then I got to eat it. We melt it and we grill it and we eat it, Moss. So I'm not assuming that I cannot be taken seriously just because of this. So I tell her, basically this is me pouring my heart out, you know? I'm pouring my heart out and I'm like, yeah, because recently I've been tired. And also, I don't sugarcoat and I don't beat around the bush. So, and also I'm very bad at secrets, because I don't understand what secrets are. And also I believe that, there are certain things that we can just talk, so that even if anybody comes and pulls that fast one on you, because I'm going to tell the world. Yeah. I would say I already told the world prior to you wanting to tell the world. So, where did you think you heard it, if not from the horse's mouth? So I'm pouring my heart out to her, and she dismisses it and says that it's like you're wishing bad upon yourself. And this offended me deeply. It offended me deeply because, one, I'm telling you the truth. Two, I'm telling you my problems. Three, you are disregarding me and pushing me aside and my emotions aside. You're not validating me. So just because and you're not taking me seriously. So just because you might think that this is something that cannot happen to me, it's happening to me. Okay. And this is my life, and this is my reality right now. And for you to make it seem like it can't be my reality because I am who I am is downright crazy. So I took great offense in this, and till today, I am at that hello. And she wants to catch a conversation, and I'm like, no. Not having a conversation with you. I'm finished, you know, like I'm done. And, like I said, I'm also a person that takes four strikes, and that was the fourth strike for her, because it's not like she has not been dismissive before. I think that this was just the last time that, that she could be dismissive towards me and my encounters and my ordeals or my conversations. If she can't have the whole full on thing, then I don't think that she's even worthy of me giving her more than a pleasantry, because, it's still bad manners for somebody to greet you and you don't greet them back, especially when you know them. You know, even if they're dead to you, you can still say, you know, except like for that one friend, but you can still, you know, if, yeah, but with her, I say the pleasantries and I walk away. And this is something that hit me hard, because I wondered why was it that, when I speak, right? When I speak, many people assume that it can't be my reality. Like, if I tell you guys something that's really bad, that's happening, especially, right? Especially when it comes to the love life, because people assume that people's love lives are so amazing and they are match made in heaven. And there is no dilemma that could ever happen between the two of you. And when it does, it seems as if you are making up fibs, because you want to be seen as, you know, seen as, I don't know who wants to be seen as a mess, but yeah, that's it. Right. So, with the active listening, so it's the dismissive card. It's the fact that, somebody tells you something, and sometimes I would like to say that, it's nice to see people think that the things that you are saying, right? Because there are so many people that are sitting with problems that are so big and so catastrophic that they don't know how to ever fix it. They don't know where to go to fix it and how to go to fix it. And they can't talk to anybody because it sounds like it's not true. It sounds like it comes from a horror movie. It sounds like their lives come from a horror movie. It sounds like a shocker. There are so many people that are sitting with crimes committed against them on a daily basis that they cannot tell anybody, because the crimes are degrading, the crimes are devastating, and the crimes are terrible. So for people like that, the minute that they say something, right, they assume, they hope that you take it as it is. But many of us turn around with ridicule. We also turn around and say that they are lying, or we are overly shocked, or we are giving them a face of some sort that encourages their shame and their guilt. Now, what we know about victims or survivors, depending on where you are on the scale, because I believe in the beginning, right? You're not a survivor. You are a victim. You are vulnerable. You are hurt. You are in a bad space. But as you start to heal, then you are a survivor. So there's a difference between survivor and victim. So at the beginning of being a victim, you tend to feel shame for the actions that, or you tend to feel shame for the things that were done upon you. You tend to feel shame for what somebody did to you. Now, this in itself comes from the fact that we are battling issues like self-esteem issues. We're battling insecurities. We're battling trauma. We're battling so much from this one little life that we've lived so far. So sometimes the insecurities, they also run deep. And if you've been told that you are not worthy from a young age, you're not worthy, you ain't nothing. When somebody comes and does something, a crime against you in any way, that kind of, for a moment, when you're in victim mode, that kind of, for a moment, solidifies it. And I'm not only talking about sexual assault and sexual harassment. I'm talking about any form of harassment towards you that made you, that degraded you, that made you feel like you are less than. So there was a time that we were talking about the potty party. It's the potty party is this party where these wealthy guys from the Arabs, from Dubai, they basically import a gang of chicks from around the globe, right? They want the European chicks. They want the Asian chicks. They want the African mommies, and they want the Scandinavian mommies, and all these girls, right, are paid And they are paid handsomely. They're not paid these pocket change things. They're paid handsomely. And what happens at the potty party is that basically you guys act out sexual fantasies and sexual indecencies, or if you consider it to be decent, then it is what it is. But basically you are a sex slave for a couple of days, and part of the activities, that's why they call it the potty party, because the potty involves feces. So what these men do is, they, to you, that's the import now. So you get something like 180 grand. For like 5 days in Dubai. They pay for everything. And you go and on this boat or wherever they're doing it, right? In the open seas. So they can't be seen for anything. Human rights, I guess. They use your mouth as a toilet. So they excrete in your mouth. They pee in your mouth, and it's feces everywhere, and you're forced to eat it. And it's just nasty, nasty, nasty. And that for me would be an act of indecency. That would be a degrading act, especially when it comes to the choice of women that they choose to partake in these activities, not being their own kind of women. So it is an Arab guy that is basically pooping in a black woman's mouth. And I find that very racist. I find that degrading. I find it like slavery. And then I also find it like, and there's also this little thing. It's not even a thin line. It's this line between poverty and wealth, right? Because I'm guessing that the wealthiest woman in the world would not be invited to a potty party because she wouldn't need your 180 grand. You understand? But, somebody that's struggling would need that 180,000. So most of the women, if not all of the women, are financially deprived and financially bound and financially not just, you know, they need the finances, and that's why they would opt to do something that degrades them to some degree. You understand? So that's the potty party. So where I'm getting with this is, now imagine being one of the potty party girls or boys, you know, maybe there's one that wants to, you know, experiment with a male. And imagine being part of that experiment or that ordeal. And you now want to openly talk about it to somebody, to let it off your chest, because there's just some things that ring in our heads at night and we can't seem to let it go because it's not humane. It's not the way things are supposed to be. And this is not what you want for yourself. And okay, we see it, right? So imagine having done that once and it bothers you, or once or twice and it bothers you so much. And then you come to your partner, for example, or somebody that you trust, and you want to talk about it. You want to talk about your nightmares that you're having. You want to talk about how degraded you feel, and you want to talk about how embarrassed you feel. So now you bring it up to somebody and they completely dismiss you. They jump straight to, no, don't worry. Things, like, it is what it is. You know, life is just like that. Because people have such kosher sayings, such nonchalant sayings of what life is and what your experiences are, and devalidating you in whatever you talk about, right? They have a saying and a metaphor and a punchline and a verse and a phrase for every single encounter that you're having. Now, I know that I say that there's nothing new under the sun, but certain things are definitely more creative than others. So imagine having been in a position like that. There is now the question of, was it voluntary, or were you actually being held captive to it because of your financial situation? And this is also something that we can look at in the line of prostitution. I've never met a woman that openly says, right, when sober, because I've met a couple of them that under the influence, you know, they talk about their prostitution. They talk about selling themselves, you know, openly. But I also understand Dutch courage. Dutch courage is drinking alcohol so that you can have the courage to say what you need to say. And I understand intoxication. And I understand when you are just not in all your faculties. You understand? So I've never met a woman that openly says when she is sober, not unless it's a documentary, not unless it's an interview of some sort, that openly says that they are prostitutes and they are proud of it. No, because it is not an honorable profession. It is not an honorable thing to be doing. It is basically degrading yourself to become, right, a bag where we drop our sexual fantasies and we exploit and extort your body and you take it, because this is the level where you're at. And mostly it is not because it is intentional or it is by choice. It is always led by something. There is no woman in this world that wants to be sleeping with multiple men for money, right? Simply because she wants to feed her kids. It's because there's just no other way. And it's just because there's just no future prospects. I understand, right? That, to be honest, I would say that let's do something else. Let's do something else. Let's try something else before we jump to prostitution. Prostitution should not even be an option on our tables, you know. Let's sell chips. The problem is that sometimes life's finances, they require larger sums of money. So you can sell chips, but chips doesn't make, you know, as much money as that other one, the pum pum. So imagine now having been a prostitute for maybe 5 years, having slept with over 20,000 guys and some women, and now coming to a point where it psychologically messes with you and you want to talk about it. And when you talk about it, right, people say things like, ah, no, don't wish yourself a life like that. Like what? Like you say, like, you know what, sometimes I think about what my life would have been if I didn't take this route, if I didn't start this. And then you, the motivator, you, the encourager that doesn't want to do active listening because it's boring, better. Somebody else's life is so boring that you don't even want to allow them to finish expressing themselves because you are not really a sad person, Vati. And this person expresses to you and you dismiss it. You dismiss it and then you jump straight to encouraging. Because I know those are things that you did in your past, my sister. You must just be grateful now that you are a child of God, because now you guys are born again or whatever. Does that mean that I actually get to express myself? If you're dismissing it with your Jesus talk about you are clean now, eh? You jump straight to you are clean now. It seems like Christians don't want to listen to anybody's story. It seems like Christians don't want to listen to uncomfortable conversations. I think the only person that is willing to listen to uncomfortable conversations wholeheartedly is usually just the pastor. It's usually just the preacher. But members of the pastor's team, they have difficulty with truths, especially truths that they deem to be inappropriate. They have a tendency of not being willing to accommodate conversations of that nature. And maybe they lack the strength, maybe they lack the knowledge to console somebody in a situation like that. But hey, we're here to talk about it. And if you're listening and you're part of the church ladies, the church gang, maybe it's time for us to change. Maybe.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low because I donated blood.
Call NHP on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
ShopRite is celebrating 35 years in Namibia. Thank you for your loyalty. We couldn't have done it without you. Join us for amazing birthday specials across the store, from groceries to household essentials and more. It's a way of giving back. Pay just 18.99 Namibian dollars for 500 grams Nawa Omasi and 16.99 Namibian dollars for 2 liters Pepsi, Miranda or 7-Up Cold Drink. ShopRite, 35 years of value you can trust always.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Great news! Imba just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Imba? Get all exclusive features for just 36 Namibian dollars a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
No matter where you are, if you have a mobile device, you can tune into Namibia's number one talk radio station by downloading the Eagle FM app on the Google Play Store or on the Apple App Store. Download the Eagle FM app to tune into live Eagle FM programming or to listen to podcasts of previous broadcasts. Eagle FM, Namibia's number one talk radio station.
Alrighty. So, ladies and gentlemen, imagine that. And okay, so we are going to run down. So it's active listening. This is eye contact. This is putting everything aside. This is you saying back to the person what they feel, right? So I tell you that, I'm very mad that this guy just took my car and there was a story where a woman's boyfriend was cheating on her and he was using her car. And when he was using her car, he was with his mistress or his side chick in the car and they got into an accident and they died. The car was written off completely. And then he was also cheating and then they died. So that woman, now the one, the girlfriend, imagine the amount of betrayal. Imagine the amount of turmoil. Imagine the amount of, pain. And on top of that, you have no one to really have a conversation with. So active listening in this case would be her saying that, yeah, I'm really mad, you know, because people say that it's impossible for us to be angry with dead people, but many of us are walking angry at dead people. We are walking angry and we are not identifying our true emotion when it comes to dead people, because the dead cannot be questioned. And also the dead, right? The dead are gone and they're supposed to be preserved, especially when you come into contact with everybody else that also knew the deceased and they are speaking of great things. There are some aunties that come to your rescue when they give their speech at the dead abusive wife or the dead abusive boyfriend. They come to your aid and they speak the truth about them, but it is very minimal where we talk and we talk about Nyelifa's real, true, like real original colors, and we talk about his true personality, and we talk about how abusive he was and how he wasted other people's children. It's very rare that that happens, but sometimes there's an aunt from his family that knows what you've gone through with him and can speak up on your behalf as you go and give your lovely speech, because you cannot be angry. So now imagine a person that is angry like that, and this person comes to you and says that, "I'm so angry at this guy. I'm so angry at this guy for everything that he's done and put me through life and even in death. I'm so angry for the shame. I'm so angry for the embarrassment," because all of these things come with shame. Shame is our go-to as human beings, when bad things happen, and they happen to us. 90% of us are embarrassed of bad things that have happened to us that have nothing to do with us. And we take it on as our own little projects and as our own little burdens. And it turns into a catastrophe later, because we are embarrassed on behalf of somebody that should embarrass, that is not embarrassed. And we can't differentiate from the two. We can't identify whose shame is whose, because we want to have a portion in it. And sometimes we want to have a portion even in the bad things, because we want to hold on to the anger and hold on to the memories of this person, whether they are alive somewhere living their best lives, or they are 6 feet underground, and sometimes even 8 feet underground. We tend to hold on to other people's doings, right? Actions, or lack thereof towards us. And we grovel in that guilt and the shame. You feel guilty for being, so vulnerable. You forgive yourself. You become guilty for being stupid. You become guilty for allowing, because 90%, 99% of the time when people do bad things to us, not unless we're being groomed, right? We know it's bad. We know that this is bad. We know that we shouldn't be going through this. We know that nobody should be going through this. But the fact that we allow, we feel guilty for allowing it. We feel guilty for letting it go on for so long. We feel guilty for this. And then we feel ashamed for being guilty of allowing it. And it's shame, shame, shame. But shame and embarrassment comes and covers up the true emotions of sadness and grief. Sadness and rage and resentment. But we're not taught to have that. We're not taught to allow ourselves to be angry, regardless of who it is. We're not allowed to be angry with our parents. We're not allowed to be angry with our spouses. We're not allowed to be angry with our friends, our siblings. We are supposed to make up eventually. And even in times where you were wronged so bad, the world will find a way to make you doubt that you were wronged, to make you doubt that this was just blatantly wrong. So you find a young female in Namibia. She walks around or she doesn't even walk around. Let's give a typical thing. You're going to the shop. You're going to go and buy airtime because you want to come and finish your assignment. On your way to the shop, there's a bush. You run through the bush, and in the middle of the bush, there's just this creepy guy that's standing there. Let's call him Lucas. He's standing there, and this guy decides to jump you and to rape you. And the first thing that anybody would ask you in this country is, "What were you wearing?" Now, does what I'm wearing give somebody the green card to violate me? That's the question. So now, how am I not going to feel guilty for wearing a tracksuit? Maybe the tracksuit was too tight, maybe. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, right? But it's a loose tracksuit. Maybe it was shaking too much. Or maybe it is the big oversized t-shirt that I was wearing. Or what is it? You end up feeling guilty for somebody else's monstrosity towards you. And it's because society always sides on the side of the perpetrator. There is no justice when it comes to the words that are uttered from people's mouths, because them too, they are perpetrators. I've learned along the way that Most things, most ordeals, we can only truly define and understand them once we've walked in those shoes. So if you haven't walked in those shoes, no matter how many telltale signs and books you've read and podcasts you've listened to and matriarch shows, you truly cannot truly fathom what somebody else is going through in certain situations because it's not you. That's why I say that death only hurts when death is in your house, because when the mourners go and you're alone, that's when you notice the absence of the person that left. So during the process of the burial, right, that's not when you're healing. That's not when you're holding on, and that's not when you're strong, because in that time, you are going through a phase that we call flight mode, where the whole entire system is on autopilot. You go with logic only. What is logical? Logical is that somebody is dead, they need a coffin. Somebody is dead, there are people in the house, they need to eat. Somebody is dead, we need flowers. Somebody is dead, we need to make their last wishes known and their last wishes fulfilled. Somebody is dead, you have a blueprint, because the blueprint comes with logic. You're not healing. So what happens now when your spouse is going through this? How do we support people that we are supposed to spend the rest of our lives with, that we would only want to see happy, that we would only want to see succeed because we love them. We love them, we cherish them, we want them to be the best versions of themselves. So what now? What happens? It's difficult. It's a journey, I'm telling you. It's so difficult because it's not like any other. Supporting a spouse through emotional distress can either make or break the relationship. That is why you find people that came from the slums together, right? And somebody was willing to make sacrifices. Life-changing sacrifices, right, is paying for somebody's tuition so that they can go to school because nobody's going to pay for them, and you wait so that they become successful and then they can pay for your education and then it's your turn, right? And sometimes it doesn't work out that way. That's acrimony now. Sometimes it doesn't work out that way. Sometimes, right, this person abandons you along the way. So what does that bring? Now you feel ashamed for assisting a human being that you loved. You feel ashamed, right? Embarrassed for allowing it. Sometimes you don't even utter it. But what happens now when this person that you have found this great foundation on is a mess? What happens when your wife wakes up one day and she doesn't recognize you and she's talking to other people, and this is now a mental episode that your wife is having because bam, the bipolar just woke up, or bam, the schizophrenia just woke up, or bam, you know, multiple psychosis or any kind of psychosis just woke up, and now your wife that was perfectly normal yesterday is now screaming out words and talking to people as if they are in the room. How do you support that? How do you go through that? You know, how do you come out untouched? How do you come out still intact? I've watched so many people. You know, there's a man that I hold dear to my heart as well. And there was a time that we were doing a few rounds there at psychiatric. You know, I love that place. I love psychiatric because I've never seen anybody angry there. Like, it seems like everybody's on medication there. Everybody's just chilled. Everybody's happy. Even when they're angry, they're happy. You know, even the nurses and the doctors, they're happy. You're like, oh, okay. So you guys are just on the happy pill, huh? But, you know, so this man had recently gotten married. He's a senior man. Somebody that is most probably, I would say, early 50s. He had recently gotten married to his wife. And they'd been together for a while. And literally, I found him there with a lunchbox of food. And he's taking the food back home because his wife refuses to eat because the voices in her head said that he's going to poison her and he just wants to keep her there. And that place is not for people. And I sat with him and I had a conversation and I asked him, how are you dealing with this? You know, how are you understanding this? And to be quite honest, he's a typical Vambu Tate, not a Vambu man, but a Vambu Tate, you know. He's one of those Tates that, live in the hood here, you know, live in the hood here, you know, grabbed a piece of land and made his house, Okabashukai, you know, and they live there with the family and all of that. And then he's got a mansion in the north. He's those kind of Tates, you know, has a whole mansion in the north and his village. He's also known and prominent and like that is one of those people where, over here, he is just an ordinary person. And there he's a god, you know, like most Vambu dudes. So I asked him, how are you dealing with this? Because he's from the old school, right? So how are you dealing with this? And he said that at the point in my life where I am, I'm taking everything as it comes because I've learned to not say, why is this happening to me? I've learned to not say, what is this? I've learned to just keep coming. Just keep coming until one day she gets better because also I trust the system. And for me, that was beautiful to see because one, within our culture, we don't believe in mental illnesses. We don't believe in mental distress, you know, we believe in, Pantu, you know, let's go to the people, Pantu, Pukati Kantu. Let's go to Kondudu, you know, let's go to a witch doctor, you know, somebody must have done something, you know, it can't just be genetics. It can't just be a mental overload. It can't just be a breakdown of which is also perfectly normal. It's normal. Ladies and gentlemen, it's normal for us to experience at least once or twice in our lives, right? Emotional distress, real distress, where you have no idea and your mind kind of plays tricks on you. Now, some of the distress signs that are there are part of our lives so much that even when they happen to us, we don't notice them. We don't notice them because they are part of our lives. We don't notice them because, I mean, we do it all the time, right? We don't notice it. We don't notice it because I mean, like, what? How can I notice that? That's just so silly, you know? But how many of you guys go somewhere and when you blink, you're already there? You don't, to be honest, you know how you got there, but you don't remember how you got there in all honesty because it happens. Many of us are running on autopilot. If I asked you, right, today, how did you get to work? And your way to work is the same way every single day, the same day, it's a routine, right? And there's nothing out of the ordinary. You didn't find a broken car on the side of the road. You didn't find nothing. It's just the same road you take to work. I can tell you that right now, many of you don't remember, right, word for word, how you got to work. You don't remember what the robots look like. Not unless something out of the ordinary that is not part of the routine happened. But apart from that, my friend, we are all dissociating. We're all dissociating and running into a different kind of world where things are better. Hello.
Hello.
Good evening, Tete Tonata.
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
How? Why do you identify my voice at the beginning of the conversation?
Well, you're my family, are you not?
No.
Yeah, you're my family. Even if you don't even if you don't view me as such to me.
I was supposed to impregnate you with me.
Wow, thanks.
that we closed the family gap.
Quickly, quickly.
Very fast.
Mm-hmm. Mm. All right.
Nothing in negative. Ah, I just tried to call Shaggy.
Uh-huh.
I just, no, now I can hear the frequency is around.
Yeah, the frequency is around. Thank you so much.
You guys talking and we failed, me and Benedicta.
Mm-hmm.
Some people, they failed, they stole my phone and then I went out of the country. They've been using my SIM card.
Really? They've been using your SIM card?
Yeah.
Did they call the people and ask them to send money?
I found them my something on my e-wallet.
Okay.
And I found -$19 on Tamba.
Oh wow! So they send themselves airtime. Yeah, they send themselves airtime.
I'm suffering from the terrible experience because I. It's like they choose and treat number two, and you know it was just a small phone that they answered.
Mm-hmm.
The grip.
Mm.
Yeah. I know I rehabilitated the whole situation.
You have rehabilitated the situation. Mm-hmm. You have rehabilitated the situation. We are talking about emotionally supporting our spouses.
Ourselves.
Our spouses and ourselves.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. How do we emotionally support? How do you emotionally support?
Talking on, like, with this kind of, are you able to hear me very well?
Yes, I can. Better. Yes.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
But it's on loudspeaker.
Yeah.
But I'm in the open space. I'm outside the house.
No, I can hear you.
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. No, the thing is, I told you, the thing is, are you obliged to have a spouse?
Yeah.
Or a relationship partner?
Hmm.
Are you obliged to have it?
No. It is all by choice.
And as I always tell you, the person that I have two children with left here willingly with their own political, social, economic and social choices.
Mm-hmm.
Went, and then I only asked one question.
Mm-hmm.
When we were in Windu, she never went to the park. All of a sudden, she's sitting on a certain park.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you're in Arians Place, I went there.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter whether it's immigration, whether it's police, where I have friends there. Mm-hmm. So people will obviously be loyal to me, and then they will tell me, Tonata, is that you, Frodo? But don't see now that it's human. Yeah? And imagine my kind of African. That is just exercise now.
Yeah.
I never went to a class for that.
Mm-hmm.
So the level of intelligence that I have around the country.
But that was not your only spouse. That was not your only partner.
No, but that is the mother. Hey, Queen Mother is number one.
Mm.
It's where I always invest all the resources, and it's where I hope to stay with her. You know, you where I am.
Mm.
But all of a sudden, you come back and then you
would ask, you feel better if you didn't invest anything in her?
Hmm?
Would you feel better if you didn't invest anything in her?
No.
And she just betrayed you. Would you feel better if it was just a betrayal?
I mean, hearing about that whole concept.
Mm.
No, she's a very good mother. She doesn't even ask me.
No. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about you. Would you feel better?
I'm not prepared. Whatever we share.
Okay, but how do you emotionally support?
No,
when somebody is in distress, emotional distress.
Distress?
Mm-hmm.
No, she's not distressed.
But she's not your partner. So I'm talking about when you are in relationships.
Yeah, I'm traumatized because I don't even know now whether to trust the next person or not.
Mm.
Yeah, so I'm in distress.
Mm.
That's trauma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
But it doesn't affect me in terms of how I live my normal life.
Yeah.
But it exposes me to the camboroto.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then
yeah.
I can find any tonata there in the ground mix.
Mm-hmm.
And then we go. What I got? Condomato. So. Mm-hmm. Am I safe?
No.
Because I have no commitment with that one.
Mm.
Of course. I mean, I'm still like a child. Okay. I just have two daughters with that one.
Mm-hmm.
Opo.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. Nandihara.
Yeah.
And the next person. And I don't know what scientific method I'm going to use. How they should prove to me that they are forever.
Mm-hmm.
But also as the alternative of waiting to 1060 into 1060 and get one old nene who then stumble and he can sell Kundinos in Yakuku.
Yeah.
He can sell it my house and then she grab my wife now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That is also very much an option.
Yeah.
I think many men are also just opting for that one.
Yeah. No, mm-hmm. You don't want to. It's not up to you anyway. But people who... You know this liberal approach?
Mm.
We call it neoliberal. You have done law.
Mm-hmm.
If you understand international relations, politics, and history,
mm-hmm.
the moment you liberate people, that's why you have gay rights, you have what? People would cheat on you and then they would think it's a non-issue. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
Without understanding the core value of the foundation of your relationship. Because mm-hmm. like in my own case, I was told specifically, baby, do you know that I'm pregnant?
Mm.
Yes. Yeah. So, don't give me stress. And for me, I understood very well.
It's not about them, it's about you. Don't give me stress.
Hmm? No, you are my patient, bruh.
Okay, but how do you do that? How do you support?
No, in terms of, you know, if I'm naughty with you.
Emotionally support. How do you emotionally support? How do you emotionally support your friends?
My person, Ando.
Your friend. Your friends.
Which friend?
Yeah, just your friend.
Oh, a friend like a guy.
Yeah.
No. We have different values. That's why I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
There are guys that disgust me.
Okay.
We are at a bar.
Mm-hmm.
This guy is, you know, me, I look at somebody with a nice body setup. And,
mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's a friend of mine, I will tell you.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working for him at that time in Rehoboth.
Mm-hmm.
I am proud to mention his name, it's Mandome Kawana. He told me, Tonata, in a Shiwambo.
Mm-hmm.
I told him one day, oi, Watarangoka now. We were at Metro,
mm-hmm.
at Olympia.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no. I claim a group is outside. Nebru. offended, actually.
Mm.
You see, the way we talk.
Mm.
He told me, Tanata, we need to go to Rehoboth.
Okay.
You are telling me about that one. That one, until you get in between the jinn, that's when you realize that you invited the whole family. Kucha, oponeto ka kya no problem as a family. So, and then I'm like, guy, what do you mean? He said, me bro, makla oskan. But along the way, all the way up to, it's 90 kilos to drive to Rehoboth. All women are the same, but individuals are different. Yeah. So, it's something that sounds so nasty, but it really makes so much sense, Kuta. Yeah? Oshai Gita Nivrukusi Popia because it's prohibited to radio. All our natural organs, as men and women, are trained. It depends on how better or good you use it, but it does not make you significant than the other. Do you understand? Yeah. So, and that's where I learned certain things to say, yeah. But it took me, it's a hard turn. But don't worry about people, man. You are better off on your own. If life finds you, it does. Yeah.
But then why is your gender committing suicide like this? Why do you think men are committing suicide like this?
Okay, you knowing me. Compare me to quite a few people. In person, since I was sitting with young younger, you think I'm happy to be that type of person? From what type of background do I come? It's not about culture, it's not about what, it's about who you are. Ganda putus, does it help anything? I'm aggressive, naturally. You're that easy. So I am like this. So, if I owe you, you must chill. I will pay you. I won't run away. Who will take over? Yeah. Those are the same traits that you get from Takewalenga.
But I'm asking, why is your gender committing suicide? Why do you think your men are committing suicide, your brothers, like the way they are?
I am the only brother to my sister, and my father is very strict. And I would tell you this, obviously. My father. I've seen my father because mom was talking too much. You understand? So I don't listen to this nonsense whereby you tell me your emotional well-being. And that's where I come to a point whereby I tell you, I have that access to certain individuals like Dr. Whittaker. And we're talking about that, about classroom management with a certain professor. And then he was telling me, no, he did not, actually he made Chinese students. At the same time, like for the 7:30 class and then the 2 o'clock class. But then they never attended the 2 o'clock class. And then I said, just keep taking advantage of your innovation. Because they realized that probably you were too lazy to come to class. So that's why you made them double sized. You understand? Mm. So now where does that end up? It ends up at the admin block. You understand?
Mm.
And then I was trying now to guide him. And I've never been a lecturer, so to say. But I help assist in terms of lecturing. And then I was trying to tell the guy that, listen, you put up your own rules. You should have your, yeah, I sometimes switch off my phone, and then because they are texting me over the weekend, and I said, are you feeling your students are bullying you? Yeah, they are harassing me in my own space, and I'm like, my brother, you've not done anything in terms of education, leadership, and management. Kate Mushanja taught me very well that one. And I remember, that's my chicks, because my children. You don't forget. What are you now? What are you passing on? We have broken leadership that has been taught by dead leadership. When I talk about dead leadership, it's people that have passed on.
So you mean to say that this is mostly from, it's because of parenting?
Yes.
Okay.
Reckless parenting. And that's why when I talk to my partner, I always tell her that, listen, you have two options. Either to listen to me or switch off.
Mm.
I don't understand. I'm too old to listen. And she's a kid anyway. I'm the older one. So I don't have time for children's advice. You know, my name is Kucha. Nene. Oshilongoshi, you know. I spoke to him. I took him to Kongwa back. And he was correctly given instruction not to mention that he's around. I know exactly how technically to work with all the people now. Who are you, the girl that was just born 1988 and they make you pregnant and then you all of a sudden you are telling me that you're an expected parent? Take your time. You need to take your time.
Okay.
Yeah, no. There are no two ways about it.
Okay. So it's you blame parents for even adult decisions.
In terms of
suicide, I'm talking about unaliving. I'm talking about suicide.
No, in terms of suicide, man.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether I should tell you this. This is a guy who I share a sister with.
Mm-hmm.
And he went by suicide.
Okay.
But at some point when we were in grade 9,
mm-hmm.
quite a rumble, we were told that we must do push-ups
mm-hmm.
as punishment because quite a tizano ka pori pori.
Mm-hmm.
Kapori pori, you play most coins kontegoi kako. I don't know whether, like you play, if it's a dollar,
mm-hmm.
it's a dollar, if it's a $5, or on the coat of arm, or on the other side,
mm-hmm.
on the eagle. If they match, then the other one takes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, that was not allowed. It's like, kudano karata, udeisa. It was never allowed at our school.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, we grew up in that type of environment. But then, my half sister, my big sister,
mm-hmm.
was born with one of my, I don't know. They use my surname.
Mm-hmm.
You know what my surname is?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, yeah. So, I don't know how we relate. I've never seen their father. Their mother loves me so much. I can sleep over and stuff. And you understand?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, yeah. Until that guy, he went to, you know, Kokachari.
Mm-hmm.
So, like a boy started sleeping with older women there. And then he became a victim of a suspected now a four-letter disease.
Mm.
Yeah. So now he went. Yeah. So, but yeah, I don't know. When you tell me about those things,
mm-hmm.
where did I actually rail off?
My dear, you've been derailed this whole, you've just been doing what you do. It's okay.
Yeah, but I'm just telling you that things are complex, man.
Okay,
ask me for the last time. Now, ask you directly.
I'm asking the question of why do you think your brothers, right, your fellow Namibian men are committing suicide so much?
Okay, that guy committed suicide and I was going there. I just forgot.
Mm-hmm.
He committed suicide because he was sickly. And he understood that his days were numbered.
Were his days numbered?
No. It's in Bondiambera. Like, it's not long ago. It's just to say, the person neglected diagnosing himself.
Mm-hmm.
And then the person neglected taking medication even if he was under diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I was not there also to advise. Because we're best friends.
Mm-hmm.
You understand?
Mm-hmm.
We were the same class in all that. Yeah, we shared the same surname, so I expected to see his father. That's why I started from that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just about ignorance. And people get very shocked.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when you... Let me tell you, when I knew Ongojiwa, when it was Ongojiwa,
mm-hmm.
I only had one girlfriend.
Okay.
Yeah. That time, these boys, may so rest in peace, Omlaule was not even there.
Mm-hmm.
I was still driving him around and then, you know,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I was dropping him off his team. It's new them.
Mm.
Even when I had to go back to Ongojiwa, I knew how, when I was at Destiny Hotel.
Mm.
I remember, Tatendakunda is my uncle.
Okay.
Yeah. So, when he was counselor there, when they were even, that was on his way out.
Mm.
I was working on that project for the Shifiwa, of my end, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, but this is Yugambo, 1989. So, I used to sleep at what there. I knew what town to get to, and I knew what I was exposed to.
Mm-hmm.
But then now, when you find the young people, and that was the time when Kasarande was also coming, when Chicago was closing up in terms of, you know, this prostitution. Yeah. So, I knew exactly in the environment where I was that you are exposed to danger
mm-hmm.
and you are what, and us, me and my boys, like I'm saying, Yonglaule and others, they would tell me, no, that is because, Zimo, now I'm holding one in the handbag. No, don't do that. Mm-hmm. That one is very dangerous. And I'm like, you guys are just jealous. You understand? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so some of the people, they would find themselves in a compromised position to say, mm-hmm. how healthy are you? And I'm not saying, but my brothers, as I mentioned their names, they kept some of us in order to say, bro, the abortik is hard. Sometimes you find yourself, you are compromised in terms of your health, and then you go. Or maybe you are owing too many people, and then you go. You are too embarrassed to be exposed to about what not and what not. It's all about individual expectations and status. Status, which can be actually a status, or it can be it can be a figment of your own imagination. Whereby you want to maintain that, or you think that you are there. But because then you are defeated by the circumstances of life, then you it's either you, and to be honest, I did not tell you this. There is a girl who was telling me that it is love that asangwapo po kings, that asangwapo ko kote mbongolo.
Ani wangini?
Asangwapo.
Asangwapo?
Eba, he partner.
Like she was kicked.
Like atairwapo otair.
Oh.
Like, and then not best friend, and that you go kings, best friend, you take Congo. You take with the kings, kings and I can make it.
Chops.
And she's telling us, but, just now, I was in town. No. I just arrived at home. It's love. I did not even comment on that. But I moved from where I was sitting and I went to the other table with another professor, guy friend of mine. We went to discuss that. That's in that case. Ohoriacha meaning out of Sangwapo, Uka, like, your whatever that your shoes are, okay, and you have a mark, and then the dress that you are putting on is a stain on it and all that. And I'm like,
it's not that bad.
You still say that is love. Yeah, I'm not going to do it. Even the other girls that love me. Maybe you are hypnotized.
Wow.
No, I'm just saying, because I mean, at what point can you go as a loving person of another?
Yeah.
Do you know what?
What?
It took me just one question for me to get dumped.
Just one. What was the question?
Good job. Then, on whose bucky back are you sitting? I can't remember what you got back.
Yeah. And then?
I am going to go to the swing and I'm going to go to the swing. Whoa, it's already war now. Yeah, who are you? And I'm like, sky. We don't go to the balcony. Yeah, you don't like it. You don't drink. But all of a sudden, you're drinking that alcoholic drink. On whose bucket deck are you?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you start questioning me. Yeah, and anyway, so before when I went to leave alcohol, and I'm like, are you asking me between my dear and you? Yeah. And I'm like, have you ever had an issue with my dear? Like, if you say I drink so much, I will understand. If I smell bad, tell me about it. But I always shower, brush, and come in bed. Mara, don't make it an example or an excuse to brush off my question. I ask you, for example, finido, our relationship is good. Yeah, so, anti-crombo is like that, like, somebody that would come home, I'm with the kids, my stepdaughter and my two daughters, like biologically, and then I would still see you, and then I would just take my bag and go. That's me. That's what I did. So you tell me about suicide and stuff and whatnot, disappointment.
Yeah.
For me, to have two children with you is a huge investment.
I think you guys must stop looking at women like investments. It's not an investment.
No. I'm worried about where you are going as my partner. In as much as we are not together anymore, where are you taking my children? Who are you going to expose my children to?
You cannot tell me who are you going to expose my children to. No, my dear. If I don't want, I don't want.
Yeah. Why?
They're not investments. Women are not investments. People are not investments.
No, it's not about women investments. But then because I confronted you about your infidelity, not qualify you to supervise and things that you are right.
One day you are going to like somebody so much, ne, that you are going to need to heal from this.
No,
you've just never met, you've just never met anyone that you like enough.
Do you know that, I'm so worried considering my age now, 40. I can't have babies.
You can.
No, listen.
You are going to be like 45 and your baby is 1 year old.
No.
Yes. That's your reality.
My father, if I deduct my age from my father, he will be 39.
Yeah.
Now, so for me, I respect that company and it's my role model. So there are levels in terms of how you take things. I can't be struggling now looking for millions for the girls. Yet I have to buy nothing. It's a lie.
Okay.
Yeah. So unless exceptional circumstances, that last girl that I would just probably bump into and something happens, and then, honestly, if she goes, I don't have a question. Okay, I'm one of them. I'm the one who's going to be. Now, who's going to take care of this baby?
You are going to take care of your child.
Uh-uh.
God will also give you a long life, my dear. God will not give you your last born at the age of 47. And take you away at the age of 50. You will live long.
You are talking God.
Eh?
God does not give.
God will give you life.
It's like it that gives you. God does not entertain your inconvenience. God only guides you. He does not talk. He does not lie. Okay. One thing, certain things that we should do next, because I thought I was done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I'm not done. So, back to sender now.
It's hectic. It's hectic. So, I understand.
Yeah,
and there are just certain people in life that we will never, there are just some things that are just not for them. But I hope you find healing, Tadete. I hope you heal one day.
That's why I'm saying, we are talking about suicide and other issues. I've never contemplated, you know, when I was a big user, I was denied.
Mm.
My 667,000. The current president was my appointing authority, yet she said,
go back. I understand.
That's why I'm saying, yet when you get such rejection from administration, but you administratively got into a position through the same person who rejects a responsibility.
Mm. Okay.
Wafawa Varwa.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother ran away.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go back to your grandmother, and then your grandmother says, I did not commission your best. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
And that is not. So I should I get angry?
At this point, Tetonata, I'm just happy you're good.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm.
That's what I've been trying to explain. For me, I'm not a crybaby. I'm a cool guy. I told you on two occasions, two girls, at one point I tried to, like, let's go sleep. We went up to my place. They took a shower and dressed. Next thing they get into bed with me, I try to touch them. But me, I like to just like my brother. I slept next to them. Without forcing issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because I understood their humane aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they did not have the same type of energy with me, but then they had the type of energy to kiss me in the bar, hug me, dance with me,
mm-hmm.
motivate me to come and sleep at my place. I mean, how do I sleep with my sister? I do, like, next to, but I've never. But of course, you get surprised, as you said, element.
Okay.
In as much as you are disappointed, you should know your limits.
Okay.
Yeah, uncle.
Hey, Watatiti, thank you so much for your strong, strong words.
Let us hear other perspectives.
Let us hear other perspectives. All right, my dear.
Yeah, uncle.
Ciao, ciao.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are doing the round here on Pulling Heartstrings, and yeah, we're talking about your perspective on how we should support our spouses and how you would support your spouse, and through what ordeals do you believe that spouses should be supported, and maybe we can take it from there. But there's also a wide question of why we're having so many. And I have my opinion. My opinion is because it's not many. I don't believe it's many. I just believe that, men are efficient people and men get it right. But it's because I've seen the inside, and it's because I've seen it, that I know that a lot of women are attempted. And at the end of the day, when it comes to media, attempted suicide doesn't make the front page, you know? So suicide makes the front page. But we're talking about emotional support because we are initially talking about emotional distress, and we are talking about wanting to be there for people that you feel deserve to be there for. So, it is a wonderful, wonderful Friday afternoon. I mean, Friday evening, and please stay tuned.
Stock up for August with real value at WB. Get a 2-liter Pepsi now for a sweet $14.99. 750ml WB cooking oil for only $26.99. 1 kg Sunlight hand wash powder for just $36.99. And 50 High Baby Active diapers at only $124.99. See all our real value deals at www.vurmanbrock.com. We care.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any
Want to know
staff.
About Namibia's latest business and economic news?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The Faculty of Commerce, Management and Law of the University of Namibia is pleased to present the hybrid face-to-face and online annual international conference on sustainable and equitable financial systems, SEFS, to take place on the 21st and the 22nd of October 2025 in Windhoek, Namibia. Authors, young researchers, academicians and practitioners are invited to submit their abstracts. The submission of abstracts deadline is the 3rd of September 2025. For more information, visit the university website at www.unam.edu.na. Thank you so much.
Great news! IMPA just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of IMPA? Get all exclusive features for just $36 Namibian a month, or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything IMBA has to offer at an unbeatable price. IMBA, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
Alrighty. So, ladies and gentlemen, you know how we do on our Fridays, right? You know how we do on our conversations here, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about how to support, how to emotionally support our spouses, right? And who is best at conversations like that if not people that have been in situations that you would never ever dream of. Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to listen to a few experienced people, right? And we're going to listen to what they have to say about supporting spouses through difficult times. How about a conversation about supporting a partner or a person through ailment, something like cancer? How do we do that? So, ladies and gentlemen, this is not the property of Eagle FM. We strictly play these clips for illustration and learning purposes. We, as Eagle Media House, take no ownership and claim no ownership for the clips that we play. Thank you so much.
Imagine you just found out a dear friend has cancer. What on earth do you say? Today I'd like to have a conversation about cancer so that if you find yourself in that kind of a scenario, you are more prepared to be the best friend possible to that person. I'm a 2-year survivor, and I've had the privilege to speak with a number of other warriors about our shared experience. And today I'd like to pull back the curtain a little bit and share some insights from this side, some mine, some from that group, so that if that awful C word does come up, you are more prepared. And chances are, if you haven't had that conversation, it's probably coming soon, because the numbers are scary high. I recently read it's 1 in 8 for my particular flavor. And I want to start with two things for those conversations that nobody warns you about cancer, and I wish they had me. And the first thing is that cancer isn't this simple concept that you can put an easy label on and be done. We talk about heart disease or diabetes or a root canal, like there's this tidy little box that it fits into. But not so with cancer. There are a couple of types of lung cancer, a couple of types of colon cancer, multiple types of breast cancer based on a number of different factors. Which leads to the second thing about cancer. The diagnosis isn't just an event, it's also a process. One really tough visit to the doctor could be followed by what might be weeks until you get a really firm sense of what's going on. It may not be until the other side of surgery. Stage and treatment plan can change. There are multiple doctors involved, and test after test after test, which means that it's virtually impossible to get your footing. That rug gets yanked out from under you, and the ground does not quit shifting. And while you wait, you fret about your family, and you wonder about whether or not you're going to die. And darn it, life does not have a pause button. There's still work, and bills, and my daughter, and the dog with allergies, and the house cleaning, and the laundry don't stop. And the crazy doesn't stop when you finally make it to treatment either. Maybe it's chemo, maybe radiation, maybe both. Maybe it's pills, which means hazmat disposal at home. The list of side effects is long and pretty scary, and maybe they change over time. Maybe it just makes you tired, like the folding a basket of laundry makes you feel like you've run a marathon kind of tired. Or maybe the meds to keep you from being sick make it so you can't sleep no matter how tired you are. Or change the way your favorite foods taste. Now they taste like mildew or aluminum foil, and that's not awesome. I've talked to some people who never wanted to be a burden or a bother to their children. And what about my husband, who's now carrying the whole load? How did just 12 weeks of treatment somehow feel like a geological age? And do I still get to talk about things I want to do 5 years from now or not? And into the midst of this, now you, my sibling, my friend, my colleague, maybe you heard about my news and you want to check in. Maybe we were talking and it just came up. You're concerned, you want to do something if you can. For better or worse, though, oftentimes when we hear that word cancer, the first place we go to is to death, or maybe that worst image we have of chemo. And we're challenged by living in a society that doesn't do well talking about bad stuff, like life insurance or depression, or sometimes just admitting we're having a tough time. Even in communities of faith, we struggle. We go to that inspirational quote, that sports analogy, that favorite scripture. We try and take the edge off somehow. Look for that silver lining. But when we're too quick at that, we lose that current challenge and the pain and the discomfort in this process. So what can you say or do to be an effective friend? Because remember, the ground is still shifting for me. I can't get my footing. We're in Florida, that hurricane I'm trying to stand in. What can you say or do? Let me start with three topics. It's probably okay that you can just skip over. And the first one, interestingly enough, is stage. And I get that you're trying to understand how serious this thing is or what might happen. But stage one doesn't mean it's easy. And stage four doesn't necessarily mean I'm about to die. Stage is really for the doctor's record keeping and is not a good barometer for how I'm handling it. So since it's not real helpful, let's skip that one. The second thing you can probably skip over is my hair. And I get that you're probably trying to encourage me because we live in an image-obsessed society after all. Maybe I am afraid to lose my hair. Or maybe that clump that came out in my hand is the worst thing I've experienced and I don't want to talk about it. Or maybe in the middle of that crazy hurricane, the last thing I'm worried about is my hair. I don't have to shave my legs either, so it's not all bad. But whether it's irrelevant or difficult, that the emphasis on image can just feel a little weird. So skip that one too. The third topic you can probably leave off the table for now would be alternative treatments or my diet. And yes, you might have read about this really neat herb or this amazing superfood, or maybe you're worried if I don't change my diet, I won't beat this thing and you want me to live, and I appreciate that. But until such time as chocolate really does cure all ills, remember that my emotional and mental capacity is pretty taxed right now, and I may not have a whole lot left to defend my own research or my choices. So if instead you make a comment like, there's a ton of stuff online right now in there, that keeps me out of that defensive place and gives me options to talk with you to the level that I feel up to it. The conversation gets harder, though, and it's more important for you to be that really great friend when talk of the process comes up. Because much like me, you probably want this thing out and gone before it can go any further. But even if you're frustrated by the process that insurance can sometimes create, or maybe you even wonder if my doctors know what on earth they're doing because they're sending me for one more test, now isn't the time to debate that. These doctors are, generally speaking, wonderful people who hate cancer as much as you and I do. They may have family touched by it. They're probably as frustrated by insurance. They're looking for the least impactful option with the best possible outcome, and I'm asking them every question I possibly can. So if you say something like, I've heard this process can be confusing. Again, it keeps me out of that defensive place, and there's a camaraderie in it. Like you get it at some level, and you're walking along with me. And most of the time, that's all I need. But while we're talking about doctors and the process, let me just mention, and as a reminder, that in our daily lives, most of us don't actually like talking about our health issues. And cancer opens this really uncomfortable door. And talking about the type of cancer I have, or the treatments, or the surgery, it can get a little odd, a little weird or uncomfortable. Many men, for example, may not want to talk about the side effects of prostate cancer. And may not want to tell you it's cervical cancer. If I say it's lung cancer, will you think I deserve it because I smoked? And can I just say as a breast cancer survivor that while I think it is absolutely wonderful we talk about it more from an early detection standpoint, when you bring that down to the personal level and you start to ask if they're going to take the lump or all of it or why not both? Seriously, if you have not at least once bought my dinner, why are we talking so much about my breasts? Just go easy. Instead, in those situations, ask things like, do you mind if I ask? Do you want to talk about it? Those are gentle and more respectful. And if I don't, it's probably going to come back around. We're just going to catch up about it in between those rain bands. In the meantime, just say, okay, I'm thinking about you. Another alternative is, I'm sorry you're going through this. That's totally acceptable. Because that just acknowledges how crummy this thing is, and that you care. Because even when the prognosis is really good, it can still really hurt. And in those impossible storms where the rain just won't stop, knowing that you've got that support means a lot, so much more than you may ever know. And that simple statement is also something I can't argue with. You care, end of sentence. Because conversely, I have no idea how to respond when you say that I'm brave. Brave is running into a burning building on purpose, and I didn't choose this. And I'm very aware of every moment I feel anything but brave. When you say that I'm strong, you don't see me at home or in the dark moments when I break down. You might be trying to encourage me by saying, I don't seem sick, but that just discounts the things that you can't see. If you think I'm handling it well, I want to know how much money you have, and let's play poker. So yeah, if you want to comment it, qualify it like that and say, yeah, I don't know how you feel at home, but it gives me the wiggle room. It's a similar kind of place where you offer prayers for my healing, and trust me, I want to beat this thing too. But specifics about outcome are that tricky place, Because it doesn't always end well. What if I still die? So if instead of or alongside those prayers, you offer prayers for peace in the process or comfort in the challenge, those are promises that I can hang on to, and they oftentimes mean so much more. But to be that really wonderful friend, I want to give you one tip that will keep me out of that place for any time for internal dialogue. And it works like this. As a function of our daily lives, we all keep track of things at different levels. Some things involve mental gymnastics. Other things, I can answer without any thought at all. I know what I'm doing tomorrow. Next Friday, I've got to think about. So when you ask me that seemingly simple question, what can I do? It's actually anything but simple. Because in order to answer or see what there might be for you, I have to catalog everything that's out there. There's my daughter at school, there's the dog and the doctor's appointments and the groceries. And if I ask about this or if I mention that, is that something you can do? Is that something you can help with? And you can see I'm right back in the middle of that storm. So instead, offer something like, could I bring you dinner? Would you like one of those housekeepers for the weekend? My brain never has to engage to answer that question. I would love a maid, but I want to prep my mess first, so let's go with dinner. Offer one, or at most two, concrete suggestions. Because when we're talking about the process or treatments, any of that kind of stuff, broad and open-ended is really, really helpful. But if you want to make a suggestion about action, specifics help here. You can do my thinking for me. So if it's dinner, instead of what day works, because again, I've got to keep track of everything for that, suggest, does Tuesday work or is Wednesday better? I've got 2 days to consider. Instead of, what sounds good, or what do you like, is Italian okay, or do you want that chicken from the store? Because trust me, nothing tastes as good as anything I don't have to think about. But what if neither option works? Despite how it may feel in the moment, it's no big deal. Okay, I'll try again sometime. It's like in a normal world, let's say I'm trying to get together with one of my girlfriends and our schedules don't work out. We just try again sometime. No big deal. And I want to emphasize this point here. The basic social contracts still hold with cancer. Yeah, I've got cancer, and to a certain extent I'm trying to find a new normal in this, but I'm still me. I'm still a wife and a mother and a sister and a daughter, and I have a job that I love and things I want to do and books I want to read and places that I want to go, and sometimes I just don't want to think about my cancer or be defined by it. Sometimes if we can just have a conversation and ignore that elephant in the room for a minute, that's a real gift. Just ask if I want to go to the movies, not if I feel up to it. Because let's say that you know, in the normal world again, that I'm dealing with that, oh, darn it, my metabolism's just starting to slow down thing, right? You're not going to ask me about my diet every time you see me. Sometimes being a great friend means not asking. You're not insensitive. Because let's say we get to talking about work, or the kids, or the weather forecast, or that great game the other day. You're going to hear how I'm handling things without having to ask. And you might hear something that you could do for me. Maybe today I'm actually feeling okay. Or maybe today I've got the smile so that I don't get stuck in a bad place. Or maybe today the smile is for you so that you don't feel awkward either. Because cancer can get awkward for both of us. And it can be isolating. So this is my last tip for you. Let me still be a friend to you. Let me hear about your life and what's going on. But if we're talking about you and your storms for a bit, because we all have them at some point, don't back up and say, but it's nothing compared to what you're going through. That steals from both of us. You're allowed to have junk. This isn't a competition, and there's no objective standard anyway. And when I get to hear about you and your storms, I still feel useful, and I still feel connected. And our relationships are arguably the most important things in our lives anyway. So when storms come to the people around us, we naturally want to help. And if that storm is cancer, here's what I hope you remember from today. The cancer is a crazy process, and it's different for everyone. So be patient. If you're talking about the process or treatment at that point, just keep it broad and open-ended. But if you do have an idea, an action, something you want to do, be specific there. That can help. Help that person think when you can. Most of all, treat them for who they are, not what they've got. And my hope then is you're more prepared to be the best friend possible. And you cannot just mean well, but do well. I thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about the journey of supporting emotionally, supporting our people emotionally when they go through the turmoil that they go through. So what are the skills of a healthy romantic relationship?
Intimacy, security, respect, good communication, a sense of being valued. These are some of the things that most people would agree make for healthy relationships. And researchers would agree too. There's a large body of literature on romantic relationships that's identified the features of healthy relationships, and the list I just provided contains many of them. Researchers also agree on what makes for unhealthy relationships. Things like fighting so much that you just can't work things out. Not being able to go to your partner for support when you need it. Contempt, criticism, hostility, violence. When these problems happen in relationships, they can cause significant unhappiness. They can lead to the end of relationships and divorce. And they can literally make people physically and emotionally sick. This is why it's so critical that people have healthy relationships. But there's a problem. How many people know, I mean really know what to do on a day-to-day basis to create healthy relationships? My point is this. We may know what a healthy relationship looks like, but most people have no idea how to get one, and no one teaches us how to do so. We need to teach people how to have healthy relationships. Now, you know when we typically do so? After it's too late. It's called couples therapy. I do couples therapy, and it can be a wonderful thing. But many people come to couples therapy with so many ingrained problems and patterns that they just can't change. It's too late. You know when else we try to teach people how to have healthy relationships? Right before they get married. It's called premarital education. And this is a good idea. Teach people how to have a good relationship while they're still happy, presumably, and it can work, but in my opinion, it's still too late. Why? Because people have already selected the person they want to commit their life to. What if they've selected poorly? No amount of premarital education can make up for a bad partner choice. So the ways that we've tried to teach people how to have healthy relationships have been limited because they fail to address three important things. Genuinely knowing what you want and need in a partner and a relationship, selecting the right person, and developing and using skills right from the beginning. And I don't mean the beginning of any particular relationship. I mean the beginning, like as soon as possible. We need to teach people, especially young people, how to have healthy relationships. Now, towards this end, my colleagues and I have developed a skills-based model of relationship functioning that we believe can help people create the things that lead to healthy relationships and reduce the behaviors that lead to unhealthy ones. We've identified three skills, insight, mutuality, and emotion regulation, that form the basis for what we call romantic competence. Romantic competence is the ability to function adaptively across all areas or all aspects of the relationship process, from figuring out what you need, to finding the right person, to building a healthy relationship, and to getting out of relationships that are unhealthy. I'll tell you more about the skills in a minute, but first let me say, we didn't just make this up out of the blue. We identified the skills based on a thorough review of theory and research. And the skills really represent the commonalities across the major theories and research findings on healthy relationships. And because they represent the commonalities, we think they really can help people with all the different parts of the relationship process and with all different people, whether people are in a relationship or not. So let me tell you about the skills. The first one is insight. Insight is about awareness and understanding and learning. So with insight, you'll have a better idea of who you are, what you need, what you want, why you do the things you do. So let's say you're being really snappy to your partner. With insight, you might notice or realize that it's not that your partner's doing anything. It's actually that you're really stressed out at work, and what you really need is to relax a little bit so it doesn't bleed out over into your relationship. Insight will also let you know your partner better. Let's say your partner shows up late for a date. With insight, you'll know why. For example, maybe your partner's late for everything. It's nothing about you. It's nothing about the relationship. That's just who your partner is. With insight, you'll be able to anticipate the positive and negative consequences of your behavior. For example, you'll know that if you send that nasty text, it's not going to go well. Maybe you better make a phone call instead. With insight, you'll be able to learn from your mistakes in ways that allow you to behave differently in the future. So maybe you'll recognize that you're the kind of person who tends to jump in really quickly. You get wrapped up in the romance of things, and then things don't go well. So you might be able to say, well, you know what, the next time, I'm just going to take things a little more slowly and not repeat the same mistake. And with insight, you'll have a better understanding about what's really right for you in a relationship. Maybe you're the kind of person who really needs a monogamous relationship. You're not okay with your partner seeing other people. Or maybe you'll realize it's just the opposite, that you're not ready to settle down and you need a partner who's okay with that. So that's insight. The second skill is mutuality. Mutuality is about knowing that both people have needs and that both sets of needs matter. With mutuality, you'll be able to convey your own needs in a clear, direct fashion that increases the likelihood that you'll get them met. So let's say you have to go to a really stressful family event and you'd like your partner to be there with you. You might say directly, you know, this is going to be stressful for me. I'd really love for you to be there. You'll be a good buffer for me. Is there any way you can clear your schedule to come with me? With mutuality, you'll be willing to meet your partner's needs as well. Let's say you know that your partner really likes to go to the gym first thing in the morning. It makes your partner feel better the rest of the day. Mutuality will let you be willing to support your partner in this, even though you'd really rather have your partner stay home and in bed with you. And mutuality also lets you factor both people's needs into decisions that you make about your relationship. So let's say you get a great job offer that you'd like to take, but you know it means you're going to have to work more, and you know how important it is for both you and your partner to spend time together. With a mutual approach, you might say, you know, I'd really like to take this job. It's really important to me. But I also am concerned about us spending time together. If I promise to protect some time for us, will you be okay with me taking this job? That's a mutual approach to relationships. The third skill is emotion regulation. And emotion regulation is about regulating your feelings in response to things that happen in your relationship. With emotion regulation, you'll be able to keep your emotions calm and keep things that happen in your relationship in perspective. So you might think, oh my goodness, this is a disaster. This is the worst thing ever. How am I going to handle this? With emotion regulation, you'll think, you know what? I can handle this. This is going to be all right. There's a way to deal with this. I'm going to figure this out. Everything's going to be okay. With emotion regulation, you'll be able to tolerate uncomfortable feelings and not act out on them impulsively. So you'll be able to think through your decisions more clearly. So let's say you're waiting for your partner to text you back. That text isn't coming. You're getting really anxious. You're checking your phone every 2 seconds. With emotion regulation, you'll be able to tell yourself, you know what, calm down. The text is going to come. I don't need to check my phone every second. I'm just going to put it away and focus on the task at hand. And with emotion regulation, you'll be able to maintain a sense of self-respect and commitment to your needs, even when bad things happen in your relationship. So let's say you have a breakup. You're feeling really depressed. You're really missing your partner.
Young Namibians who have recently turned 18 years old, the time has come for you to take your first step in exercising your constitutional right of voting. Register as a voter during the supplementary registration of voters, which takes place from the 4th until the 19th of August 2025. Uphold your civic duty. Get involved. Step up for your right and register to vote.
The views and opinions expressed by
regulation, you'll be able to let yourself know that it's okay, that yeah, you're going to feel depressed, but you're going to get over it. You're going to get through this. If you beg and plead to get back together, you're not going to feel good about yourself, and you don't even want to be in a relationship that wasn't good for you. So insight, mutuality, and emotion regulation, I believe it's people's ability to use the skills on a day-to-day basis that lets them have healthy relationships. So let me give you an example of how this works. The other day I was talking to someone and she said that when her partner asked her what she wanted for her birthday, she told him she didn't want anything. So guess what? She didn't get anything and she got really angry and they had a big fight. Why? Because she really did want a present. She just didn't want to tell him. She wanted him to somehow know. It's called mind reading. It's a terrible idea. It never works. Had she been using the skills, insight would have let her know herself well enough to realize that she really did want something, and if she didn't get it, she was going to be mad. Insight also would have let her know that her partner was the kind of guy who was just going to take what she said literally. Mutuality would have let her really ask for what she wanted directly and clearly. And emotion regulation would have let her deal with any feelings she was having that were getting in her way of doing that. So maybe she was feeling kind of anxious. Oh, what would he think if I asked for what I needed? Or maybe she was feeling guilty. You know, she knows they're saving for a big trip, and she maybe thought that he would think that she was kind of greedy or something. So if she had used the skills, she would have been able to say, you know what? I know we're saving for that trip, but I really like that necklace that we saw the other day, and it wasn't that expensive. He would have gotten it for her. She would have felt respected and valued. He would have been happy. They would have felt more intimate. This whole birthday gift thing would have gone well instead of ending in a fight that could really damage their relationship. Now, this was just an anecdote. We have data to support this as well. I've been studying romantic competence, the ability for people to use insight, mutuality, and emotion regulation among young people. In one of our studies, we looked at 13 and 14-year-old girls, early adolescent girls, and we found that girls who were more romantically competent felt more secure in their relationships. They felt comfortable being close to people. They could trust people. They weren't worried about being rejected. Girls who were more romantically competent reported fewer depressive symptoms. They had better mental health. They also were more positive about their expectations about marriage in the future. They were more optimistic that it could go well. Girls with greater romantic competence were engaging in more typical romantic activities for their age, things that were normative, like dating and flirting and affectionate behaviors like hugging and kissing. And girls who were more romantically competent were engaging in fewer atypical sexual activities like sexual intercourse, which can be considered pretty risky for a 13 and 14-year-old girl. So even at an early age, 13 and 14 years old, when these girls mostly were not even in relationships, the more romantically competent they were, the more adaptive relational functioning they were showing, and the better mental health they were showing. We see the same things among young adults, 18 to 25 years old. More romantically competent men and women feel more secure in relationships. They also report making better decisions. They can see the warning signs when things aren't going well and make conscious decisions with confidence. They're also better at seeking and providing support to their partners. So they're more willing to ask for what they need and use what their partners give them. And they're better at providing helpful support when needed. And this isn't just what they told us. We actually observed them doing this in our laboratory when we asked them to talk with one another about a personal problem. Young people who were more romantically competent also were more satisfied in their relationships. They were happier. And again, they reported fewer depressive symptoms and also fewer anxiety symptoms. So overall, being romantically competent at a young age is associated with greater, more adaptive relationship functioning and greater individual well-being. And this brings me back to my point that we need to be teaching people how to have healthy relationships. So, like I said earlier on, we may know what a healthy relationship looks like, but most people have no idea how to get one, and no one teaches us how to do so. And this is a problem. We need to help people genuinely know what they want and need in a relationship. We need to help them select the right partner. We need to help them make good decisions and deal with the challenges that relationships bring. And we need to help them build and use skills right from the beginning. This is what the notion of romantic competence is all about. It's all about using insight, mutuality, and emotion regulation to reduce the behaviors that lead to unhealthy relationships, like fighting and poor support, and hostility and criticism and contempt and violence, and create the things that lead to healthy relationships, like intimacy, security, respect, good communication, and a sense of being valued. And wouldn't all of our relationships benefit from this? I think they would. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Hi. I hope that we are enjoying our Friday evening as we get to experience other people's experiences. So, ladies and gentlemen, how to love, how to help a loved one with a mental illness. How are we going to do that?
When I was 17 years old, I was in my room one night working on my trigonometry homework when I heard two sounds I will never forget. The first was the schlink of a knife being drawn from the knife holder in the kitchen, and the second was my father's voice saying, "Linda, no!" I ran into the kitchen, and I found my parents scuffling with a knife and called 911. The police came, and luckily no one had been hurt. But the next day, my mother was gone. This was the first of many psychiatric hospitalizations that followed. My life turned upside down that day. My former Girl Scout troop leader, room mother, doll clothing sewer, song singer, story reader, my mother had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. And it wasn't very clear whether she'd been suicidal or homicidal that night. To this day, I still don't really know. What I do know now is that I was woefully unprepared for the years that followed, and that no one at the time gave me any advice about how to help my mother. I wish someone had. My talk here today is what I wish someone had told me when I was 17. So it wouldn't have taken me 20 years to learn what I learned through trial and error. I hope maybe it will help save one of you a little time and a lot of hard lessons. These are my lessons from my mother. First of all, accept the situation. Take a deep breath. It'll help ease the panic you may be feeling because you've just found out someone you love, perhaps a parent or a child, a sibling or spouse, has been diagnosed with a mental illness. Mental illness is still quite stigmatized in our society and rather taboo. So when the subject does arise, we often feel very uncomfortable talking about it. But if we want to help, talk we must. And help we can. Please do not feel like there is nothing you can do. I assure you, there is. I know life may seem very turned upside down right now. And you may be tempted to pretend that nothing has changed and everything is just fine. Do not do this. Denial does not work. And it can have serious consequences. Secondly, reach out. Don't keep this a secret. Find allies and develop a network of support for you and your loved one. I remember one time, my mother was being hospitalized, and I was very worried about her. My parents were divorced by this point, and I was her main caregiver. She was being paranoid, unreasonable, hard to work with, and I didn't know what to do. So I turned to a neighbor, who's now one of my best friends, and told her about my situation, even though I was nervous to do so. It turned out she had a sister who'd been suffering from a mental illness, a serious mental illness, for years. And at the time, I didn't even know she had a sister. So you may be surprised just how many people are in exactly your same shoes. In fact, according to NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 1 in 5 Americans will suffer from a mental illness. That's 43 million Americans in any given year. 1 in 25 live with a serious mental illness. If these numbers are at all surprising, it's because not enough people talk about it. Hopefully, however, it would also help me bring you some comfort knowing that you and your loved one are not alone. So, once you accept the situation, reach out, and develop a network of support, what else can you do? Plenty. Obviously, not everyone's situation is going to be the same. Some people, once the initial psychiatric crisis is over, may be fine for years. Others, however, may suffer for years. There's a wide spectrum of experience when it comes to mental illness. There are, however, a few general rules of thumb I recommend you follow if you truly want to help your loved one. First off, make sure your help is wanted. You cannot help someone who does not want your help. I learned this the hard way. It has to be a two-way street. You need to communicate clearly and kindly with each other about what sort of help is wanted by them and what sort of help can be given by you. This will not always match up, but an agreement needs to be reached or much heartache will follow. Remember, even if you see them suffering and you just want to make it all better, you cannot live your live their life for them. Even if you think you know best how to help them. No, you must listen carefully to what they really need and what they really want from you. You may be surprised. And if you don't listen carefully, you may miss it. And one thing they may want and may not ask for is total reassurance of your love for them through all of it. Because mental illness can bring some hard times and it can do some real damage along the way. After all, at times it removes all those filters of politeness and thoughtfulness and all sorts of things they may not say in their healthier moments come out unabridged, unsoftened, raw, sometimes paranoid, and often painful. This is why mental illness can be murder on relationships, and it leads me to my next point. If you want to help a loved one with a mental illness, you have to develop a thick skin and learn to not take things too personally. I cannot emphasize this enough. Try instead to see their verbal assaults when they come, as they likely will, as signs of an illness, symptoms of an illness, just as you would a fever or a rash. Use them to help you determine when they may be in need of more significant support or intervention. Don't engage and argue that they're being irrational, especially if they are indeed being irrational. But heart and try to see the opportunity here as well. Because of their filterlessness, you may actually get to know them more deeply than you would someone who is fully healthy and can always keep their emotions under wraps. In fact, in the process, you may even learn a thing or two about yourself that no one else would be willing to tell you. But you will only reap these benefits if you can learn to weather the emotional storms that may very well be directed right at you, because you love them, and they know that. And this makes you a safe outlet and sometimes a close target. Of course, you should never tolerate any physical abuse from anyone ever. But verbal abuse may very well crop up at a time of emotional distress, and it is up to you to choose how you see it. Again, I recommend that you try to see it as a red flag, a cry for help, and not take it too personally. Stay safe, but try to be forgiving of these moments if you can. I think it is these very moments that most often drive people away from loved ones with a mental illness. I know initially they drove me away from my mother. First, halfway across the country for college, then halfway around the world for the Peace Corps. It turned out that physical distance didn't really help matters much. But when I learned to accept her emotional storms as part of her condition and to fully listen and reassure her lovingly during them, even when it was hard, even when unfair things were being said, the things actually began to get easier, surprisingly, and we grew much closer. In fact, this technique would usually help her calm her down better than anything else. So, what's another way you can help? Well, financially, of course. For the first 10 years after my mother's initial diagnosis, she did quite well with medication and therapy, and she was able to work full-time and to live independently. Over time, however, certain things began to be overwhelming. Keeping track of finances and paying bills on time could be a challenge, especially if she'd had a manic episode and gone on a shopping spree. So I offered to help manage her money, and she agreed. I would balance her checkbook, this was in the days before online banking, pay her bills, and budget her money so that she would have enough funds left over to pay for her medications each month. We would joke that I was her CMA, her certified mother's accountant. This joking made it a little easier to talk about help she was not always comfortable receiving from me. Humor can be a powerful tool in this situation. Eventually, I got a power of attorney for property so I could make financial decisions for her. And yes, money management is one concrete way you can help. Sometimes, however, this is not quite enough financial assistance. About 5 years after I had become her CMA, my mother called me up one day and she said, "I can't handle the stress of working anymore. I've taken an early retirement." Well, this was a big problem because she had retired so early, she was only going to receive $300 a month from her pension. So in a fit of exasperation, I said, "I give up. You're on your own." She replied, "Fine." I was, after all, about to get married. I had my own expenses and bills to pay. But not surprisingly, 2 months later, I found out she was about to be evicted from her apartment. I didn't know what to do. I asked many people for advice. Family, friends, coworkers, even the social worker priest at my church. And here's something that I learned. Many people who care about you and who think you're taking on too much when you try to help a family member with a mental illness will tell you it's not your responsibility. Let her be evicted. Become homeless. It's her own fault. She made a selfish decision. They will be trying to help you. You may even be tempted to listen. But they very well may be dead wrong. Only you know what decisions you can live with. I remember one day I sat down on my bed pondering what the right thing to do was. And I became very calm, and it became very clear that the only thing that felt right was to help her as much as I could. And so my fiancé, another family member, and I started to pay her rent each month. And I searched high and low for resources that would help as well. And a little miracle happened. About a year after we had started paying for her rent, she was awarded Social Security disability income. And because we'd applied right away, she got a whole year's back pay, and that covered all the time we'd been helping her. And she used that money to repay every cent we had given her. Every cent. So yes, if you love someone with a mental illness, financial issues may very well arise. And you will have to decide what you can do and what you can live with. I recommend erring on the side of generosity and kindness if you can. I also recommend that you search for financial resources that are out there, but sometimes hard to find. My mother and I found out so much, in fact, that we put together a brochure about all of the resources that we discovered called Linda's Guide to the Government, a resource list for people in need. And we gave copies of this to all the people that we had asked for help from who didn't know where to point us. In addition to finances, another area that can suffer when someone has a mental illness is relationships. You can help here too. Be a sounding board when issues arise. Help smooth things over with family and friends by educating them about your loved one's condition, with their permission, of course. Another area that can suffer is cleanliness and personal hygiene. This may not be an area they will always admit they need help in, but laundry, litter boxes, dishes, these can be overwhelming when you're in the middle of a deep depression. And their neglect can lead to a mess that makes it even harder to get out of a deep depression. So if you can, if you have the time and energy, you may consider helping with some of these things or hiring a service to clean regularly if you can afford it. Most importantly, you want to develop a close enough connection so that you can easily determine when your loved one may be in need of additional intervention or support. Over time, my mother and I developed a daily check-in system. I would call her in the morning, say hello, and see how she was doing that day. This system one day saved her life. You see, one day I called her. She was terribly upset. And she said she had just had enough. She was done. And she hung up. And she didn't answer when I called her back repeatedly. Fortunately, her best friend, a part of the network of support we had developed, lived right next door. So I called her up and asked her to go check in on my mother. She had a key for her apartment, so she went over there, unlocked the lock, and opened the door, but the chain was on. However, the door was open just enough for her to see inside and see my mother slumped over in her chair and non-responsive. She managed to finally get the door open and called the paramedics after she found the suicide note and the empty pill bottles nearby. Had I not developed a close enough connection, a daily check-in system, and a network of support, my mother would have died that day. Because I had, she was able to have her stomach pumped in time. And even though she was a little bit upset when she woke up and realized she hadn't been successful, she was given another chance, one that eventually led to gratitude for that chance and the therapy and medication and life experiences that led her to find some peace and happiness and to even have the chance to meet her grandson, my son Frankie. So, there is a lot you can do to help a loved one. But don't forget to take care of yourself in the process. Your loved one may be able to draw strength from you, but you may need to draw your own strength somewhere else. Yoga, Qigong, Tai Chi, meditation, mindfulness therapy, I tried them all. Yoga was my saving grace, so much so that I became certified to teach it. Without yoga, I don't think I could have helped my mother as much as I did. You will need to find your own outlet to handle the stress and the worry that comes from helping someone with a mental illness. Also, you need to get educated about their condition. Learn about their medications and their side effects. Know the names of their doctors and their therapists. Make sure you're familiar with their condition. And consider possibly taking NAMI's Family to Family course. This is a free 12-week course for family caregivers of individuals living with mental illness. And we'll teach you even more about how to take care of someone suffering from a mental illness. So yes, there is a lot you can do to help a loved one. And it won't be easy, but it will be worth it. When my mother was dying of cancer 5 years ago, we both regretted that we had not had the chance to write our story down together of how we had learned to work as a team to help keep her well, which in turn, because I loved her so deeply, helped to keep me well. So instead, I offer you this talk today in honor of my mother, who taught me not just how to love, to help a loved one with a mental illness, but how to love unconditionally. I hope in your journeys, you will learn to do this more quickly than I did. Thank you for listening to my talk of my proud past with my mother. I hope it will help you have a stronger future with your loved ones. Thank you.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Great news. Impa just got even better. We have added brand new features to make your experience smoother, faster, and more powerful than ever before. Ready to unlock the full potential of Impa? Get all exclusive features for just $36 a month. Or save even more with our special subscription plans. 5% discount for 3 months subscription, 10% discount for 6 months subscription, and 25% discount for 12 months subscription. Choose the plan that works best for you and start enjoying everything Imba has to offer at an unbeatable price. Imba, where the world congregates. Download it and subscribe today.
No matter where you are, if you have a mobile device, you can tune into Namibia's number one talk radio station by downloading the Eagle FM app on the Google Play Store or on the Apple App Store. Download the Eagle FM app to tune into live Eagle FM programming or to listen to podcasts of previous broadcasts. Eagle FM, Namibia's number one talk radio station.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and
Imba. Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economy news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager. Whatever you want.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal. Why do you give a tender to somebody who doesn't have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Figure of fun lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Catatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Catatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we have been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking about emotionally supporting our people through whatever turmoil there is. So it's active listening, it's validation. Validation is acknowledge and accept your partner's feelings, even if you don't understand, even if you don't fully understand or agree with them. Learn, let them know it's okay to feel the way they are feeling, you know? Just because you don't agree with something doesn't mean that you're incapable of understanding what they're going through, and reassure them that their emotions are valid and understandable in the given situation or circumstances. We have to understand things from a perspective that is not our own. It's basically taking a mile in their shoes, walking a mile in their shoes. And then thirdly, we practice empathy. Try to understand your partner's perspective and put yourself in their shoes, show compassion, and let them know you care about their experiences, right? Offer comfort and reassurance. Remind them that they are not alone. And this is how we show empathy. Now, one of the issues with supporting a partner emotionally, right, is what if your partner is not an emotional kind of person? Because most of the gentlemen that have come here to speak about this, they don't really play on that spectrum, you know. They don't really indulge too much in emotions, and some are even practicing avoidance, you know, Tatiti, practicing avoidance to speak about emotions entirely. So what if that is what you're faced with? I would say then it would be best to still go with the steps, and it's not one glove fits all, but it definitely does assist to some degree. I would say that you give them that acknowledgement. I see you handling this, puppy. I see you handling this, my husband. I see you handling this, my wife. I'm proud of you. Just that, you know. And then today we are focusing on encourage communication. Create a safe space for your partner to share their thoughts and their emotions, experiences, and feelings. Ask open-handed questions to encourage them to elaborate on their experiences and their feelings. Let them know that you are available to listen whenever they would like to talk about anything. And if they would like to ask you to contribute to a conversation, you would be more than happy to. Sometimes we need to allow people to talk. We need to allow people to talk freely and uninterrupted. And then number five is a practical support. Offer to help with tasks or responsibilities that might be an add-on to the stress that they are facing. So what if your partner is going through grief and all of that? Then offer to drive the kids to school. Offer to take up that responsibility. What if your wife is going through depression? Offer to do meal prepping for the week. Offer to cook. Offer to help out with throwing the clothes into the washing machine. You understand? Just to have one less thing to worry about. And consider offering practical solutions or resources if they are open to it. So if you think that your wife is in bed for such a long time and she's acting depressed, how about we talk about a therapist, you know? And most probably we know our partner so well. We know that the person is not going to stand up and go to a whole public hospital and go there and everybody's going to see them. So how about we do something that's toll free? How about we try Childline, where we can just talk about our issues over the phone, or we can go there? You know, there are so many resources. There are so many places. How about we try Red Cross, you know? Guys. And thirdly, be mindful of their energy levels.
and offer to help with things they might be struggling with. Because if the energy levels are low and you can feel it, you can see it, that this person is just not up for it, how about you help? It's not always about boosting somebody's energy. It's not always that. Sometimes, right? Sometimes some fights are best for you to go through. Sometimes you just have to go through it. It's not everything that we can just ignore and skip up. It's not everything that requires that, you know. And sometimes it's just sitting in being mindful of exactly what level of energy are we on today. And 7, respect boundaries. Respect your partner's boundaries and their need for space or time to process their emotions. So if your personal person decides to just come to the room and they go there and you go into the room with them, and then after like a few minutes, right, they go to another room in the house, please stop following them. Please stop asking them things like, what's wrong? What's wrong? Allow them to have that moment. They know that you are there. They know that you are alive. They know that you are there. Partner, they know that they are married to you. Allow them to breathe a little bit. Allow the person to watch a little bit of TV without interruption. Allow them to just be human. And don't pressure them into talking or sharing, right? When they are not ready. Like, yeah, just tell me how you feel. Tell me how you feel. Why aren't you talking to me? Hey, do you want to talk to other people? Don't make things about you, because this is not about you. Okay? Allow them. And then also, right? Some people get, offended when you don't actually ask. So in this case, you would have to now look at your partner, dearest, and say that, you know, I know that you're going through something. And I know that it must be terrible. I'm here when you want to share. I will listen and I will drop everything for you. I will listen and I'm here. Okay. I'm not pressuring you. I'm here. And thirdly, be mindful of their comfort levels and adjust your approach. So don't just jump on the person and don't just, hey, baby, hey, so babe, hey, how are you emotional today? Don't. Let's just keep it quiet. Keep it calm. Keep it slow sometimes. All right. And we're going to talk about self-care in just a few minutes, but I'm playing you guys clips from very emotional experiences of people that have seen their loved ones go through a lot, right? And this one particularly is something that touched my heart when I heard it. So enjoy.
At age 21, I was a senior at Brown University who seemed to have it all. I played varsity sports. I had a gang of smart, feisty friends, and with a 4.0, I was on my way to one of the finest medical schools in the country. Then, in what felt like a flip of a switch, it was as if an alien had abducted my brain. Suddenly, I couldn't add 2 + 3 when I'd aced my calculus finals a week before. I couldn't get out of bed. I locked myself in my room, afraid to see my friends. It was a tailspin into a living hell, and I was terrified. In the decades that followed, I suffered from a debilitating brain disorder. I've kept this mostly secret for 40 years until now. I'm choosing to tell my story tonight for 3 things. 1, end the stigma. 2, save lives. And 3, maximize healing. Woo! That's helpful. It took me 25 years and 5 psychiatrists to finally get the diagnosis that saved my life. I have a bipolar 2 brain on the bipolar spectrum. If you've never heard of a bipolar spectrum, you're not alone. Most people do not know it exists. Yet understanding the full spectrum and the distinction between bipolar 1, 2, and unipolar depression can absolutely save lives. Here's how. Imagine you've been lethargic, unmotivated, unable to get out of bed. You drag yourself to your doctor. The doctor looks at you, sees that you're depressed, and then writes you a prescription for an antidepressant, something like Prozac. Indeed, over 70% of the 71 million prescriptions written for antidepressants last year were written by primary care doctors with little to no psychiatric training. But if you're like me, you're not depressed. You're bipolar too. And that Prozac can act like poison for your brain. And since the suicide risk for people with any kind of bipolar is twice as high as for those with unipolar depression, in other words, people with bipolar are twice as likely to take their own lives, getting that diagnosis right is literally a matter of life and death. In preparation for this talk, I wanted to give you some accurate numbers about the prevalence of bipolar in this country. I turned to Dr. Holly Swartz, professor of psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh Medical School and a global authority on the bipolar spectrum, who has studied literally hundreds of leading peer-reviewed sources. According to Dr. Swartz, as well as the National Institute of Mental Health and the National Alliance on Mental Illness, here are some stats. 1 out of 4 people who appears to be depressed is actually bipolar. There are 7 million Americans per year who have bipolar brains, and at least half of those are on the bipolar spectrum. Now, I believe that these numbers are significantly underreported because of the stigma and because of misdiagnosis. In addition, on average, it takes 11 years to diagnose someone with bipolar 2, and that's just way too long because in the interim, the undiagnosed bipolar are among the addicted, the homeless, and the incarcerated. Their lives destroyed, their marriages ruined, their lives lost, their families devastated. It does not have to end this way. So why is there so much misdiagnosis? When you hear the word bipolar, what comes to your mind? Most people I ask will say something like this, right? Way high, extreme mood swings, wild sprees. These people are actually articulating just one end of the bipolar spectrum, classic bipolar 1, which is usually known as manic depression. However, we now know that bipolar exists on a spectrum, as depicted in this slide by Dr. Jim Phelps. Dr. Jim Phelps is a clinical psychiatrist and the author of numerous groundbreaking works on bipolarity. People with bipolar 2, like me, do not show extreme mania. And because we don't act manic, and we do have many of the same symptoms of clinical depression, lethargy, despair, low affect, extreme negativity, we are consistently misdiagnosed with clinical depression and then prescribed the wrong medications. Why is this dangerous? In an award-winning study, Dr. Phelps and colleagues tracked primary care patients with some psychiatric symptoms, hundreds of primary care patients. They found that these people were given on average 8 and up to 27 medications. 27! The point, while people with bipolar 2 are waiting on average a decade to get the right diagnosis, for me it was 25 years, they're taking all kinds of drugs that are wrong for them, each with dangerous and even lethal side effects. In my case, doctors convinced that I was depressed gave me drugs that literally made my brain feel like it was shaking inside my skull. When I'd return to the doctors much worse, they'd think, oh, she's more depressed. Let's give her more of that drug. You can see it's a brutal, vicious cycle. But now we know, now you know, that bipolar 2 is not clinical depression. It is a form of bipolar, which can respond beautifully to bipolar medications like lithium and others. So getting this right is vital because the wrong diagnosis and wrong medications can make broken brains even worse, while the right diagnosis and medications can save lives. I know. I'm proof. So I want to try to describe to you what I mean by a broken brain. I think when most people see someone depressed, they think about emotion. Oh, they're sad. Let's fix their sadness. But that's not how it is for me and millions like me. When my bipolar switch flips, my brain simply stops working. It's a physical thing. Here are a few examples of the impact. There are many more. So simple everyday conceptual tasks that I've taken for granted forever become nearly impossible. One day, it literally takes me 3 hours to unpack 2 bags of groceries. I get lost between putting away the tomatoes and shelving the cereal boxes. In constant confusion, I'm unable to sequence actions. I forget multiplication. This makes me miserable. I had 800s on my math SATs. Shopping malls and supermarkets are excruciating. There are just too many choices. How long can I stand in an aisle trying to choose between peanut butters, the organic or the not organic, the cheap or the higher priced? These decisions paralyze me, and the inability to make decisions leaves me flooded with shame and anxiety. I stopped doing laundry. It's too overwhelming to go through the sequencing of fold, sort, put away clothes. So in the kitchen and in the bedroom and the office, things pile up. And this chaos makes me crazy. And I'm too overwhelmed to fix it. And at this point, I'm desperate for company, but I feel too embarrassed to invite anyone into this scene, even though I'm terrified to be alone with my brain. I share these descriptions not to depress you, but for this. If you are suffering with something like a bipolar brain, I want you to know that you are not alone. There's someone who understands what it's like to be inside your brain. There's help. There's hope. The doctor who finally diagnosed me correctly was dedicated to understanding the complexity of bipolar. He had one of Dr. Phelps's books, and he gave me a simple 11-question bipolar spectrum diagnostic test. He asked me, did your first incident occur under age 25? Yes, it did. And do you have any family history of mood swings? Well, yes, my mother and my grandfather both suffered terribly. And when you were given an antidepressant, did it first seem to work and then make you much worse? Yes, absolutely. And with that, and a few more incisive questions, it took Dr. Perlman all of 15 minutes to diagnose what had eluded the medical world for 25 years. I have a bipolar brain, bipolar 2 on the bipolar spectrum. The medications he prescribed, as a result, gave me back my life. I find it hard to describe to you the magnitude of this transformation. From the utter devastation and suicidal longing of a broken brain to the absolute miracle and awesome blessing of a brain that works. I don't know why the brain breakdown happens. Not even the experts seem to. As I write in my new memoir, Brainstorm, From Broken to Blessed on the Bipolar Spectrum, the brain is as vast as the universe and equally uncharted. In years to come, I imagine we'll learn how rudimentary our understanding was in the early 21st century. In the meantime, we have a lot of work to do. So you want to help, right? Yeah. If you've never experienced a broken brain but know people who are suffering, and chances are you do, according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 1 in 5 people are living with a mental health challenge right now. 1 in 5. That means in this country alone, 66 million people. Right? But I want you to know that you cannot pull these people up by their bootstraps or cheer them on with your joie de vivre or shame them into just do something already. You know, these reactions are fully human and understandable, but they will not help. Here's what can. It's what I'm calling your EMT, Emergency Mental Health Team Toolkit. More on that in a second, okay? So we are presently experiencing a pandemic-induced mental health tsunami. Suicides are spiking. The U.S. Surgeon General last year in an unprecedented report declared a mental health emergency among our youth. Teenage girl suicide attempts went up by 51%. One out of two young people are experiencing anxiety or depression. One out of two. So we're in a high school tonight. For those of you in the audience, look to your left, look to your right. One of these kids is likely suffering. So how can we help? Okay, here's the Emergency Mental Health Team Toolkit I promised you. One, reach in. Don't expect them to reach out. They won't. You make the phone calls. You knock on their door. Two, listen without judgment. Don't try to fix it. You can't. Simply accompany these people with your love and presence. They feel isolated on an island of despair, and you're showing up as a lifeline. Three, just do it. Okay, this is for those of you who want to do something. Here's what you can do. You make the appointments. You take them to the doctors. You pick up the kids. You do the laundry. You choose the peanut butters. These activities are Herculean for your friend. You do them. So, and finally, four, create a posse. This is going to be too much for any one person to do, and you're going to need support so you don't burn out. And here's the good news. The community of love and compassion that you build as a result will be a blessing for all of you. So now, my emergency mental health team friend, when you reach in instead of running away and you show up with your love and compassion, you are going to be a huge shame eraser. As the author Terry Chaney writes, the disease feeds on shame, shame feeds on silence, and I will not be silent anymore. I would add that shame feeds on the stigma. There's still a massive stigma against mental illness in this country, and people feeling the stigma don't seek the life-saving help that they need. So I posit that the stigma literally kills. So what we end up with is this vicious cycle of silence, shame, stigma, back to more silence, shame, and stigma. Brutal, vicious cycle. So your showing up is going to help bust this vicious cycle. Your showing up can save a life. For example, if your friend is too ashamed to go to a psychiatrist or take medication, as I was for decades and so many are, please tell them this is not their fault, right? If they had diabetes, they'd take insulin. If they had heart issues, they might take blood thinners. If they had lung issues and needed help breathing, they might use an inhaler. Pancreas, heart, lungs, these are all physical organs, and so is the brain. Why do we treat diseases of the brain differently? It's time to stop that. My mentor, Juanita, who finally got me to accept medication, said to me, "You don't deserve to suffer. You've done nothing wrong. This is genetic. This is physical. Just say yes to help." And because I loved and respected her, and because I was hanging a life by a thread, and because I had two little kids by then who needed me, I finally said yes. I wish it hadn't taken me so long. So here's what else we can all do for those of us who want to do something. I call them Practices for a Healthy Brain, and I use the acronym PECS to help me remember. Physical, emotional, creative, and spiritual. Flex your PECS. I practice my PECS for preventive medicine with religious discipline because my life depends on it. But I promise you they are essential good medicine for anyone with a brain. Because raise your hand out there if you're not feeling any mental stress these days. Okay, one hand, I'll have what you're having. No, the truth is that we're all under a lot of stress. So the idea with the PECS is to create balance in your life and do one or more activity in each of the four, physical, emotional, creative, and spiritual, every day. As the poet Audre Lorde writes, this is not self-indulgence, this is self-preservation. So here are a few of my PECs that work best for you if you do what you love, okay? So physical, that means just get moving, get aerobic. Bike, hike, swim, whatever you love. As we know, endorphins are big mood boosters. Emotional, connection is essential. Human beings are social beings. We were not put here to be alone. So you can even be efficient and combine your physical and emotional and go out for a hike with a buddy. C is for acts of creativity. That's like singing, dancing, cooking, painting, drawing, whatever you love. These are all brain restorative. And finally, for S, for a spiritual PECS, I am a big fan of disconnecting from technology so that we can reconnect with nature. We are not evolved to stare at screens for 8 hours a day. So going outside to some place beautiful is calming for the nervous system and soothing for the brain. And then walk, play, pray, meditate, whatever you do to help connect yourself with something larger than yourself, that's all good for the brain. I'm over-disciplined about my pecs because, you know, my health depends on it. And my friends and family tell me that this discipline is inspiring for them and good for their health too, which is a bonus. Who knew? And this leads me to what I want to leave you with tonight. It's what I call bipolar pride. People who live with bipolar and other neurodiverse brain patterns have suffered in silence, isolation, and fear. They have internalized the vast social stigma that there's something wrong with them, and many are riddled with shame. Is this okay with you? No. So let's tell a different story now, a healing story. These people are champions. They are survivors of internal terror who have risen like a phoenix from the raging fires and emerged with qualities of character and soul that are beautiful. They are emotionally fearless friends. There's nothing you can do to scare them away that their brain hasn't already done to them. They will not leave you. They're off the charts compassionate. There, but for the grace of God, they could be on the street too, and they know it. They will not judge you. They are grateful, grateful beyond measure. And this gratitude is contagious. Because when you've been to hell and back, every healthy moment, every moment when your brain is working, is a miracle. Let's celebrate the miracle. Thank you.
With a divorce. And tonight I want to share with you some of the lessons we've learned about how people heal and put their lives back together after these difficult experiences. And to start telling the story of our research findings, I want to start a bit more broadly by talking about what I've come to call what now moments. For all of us, life is full of these what now moments. And essentially, they're forks in the road. They're major transitions. They're turning points. So when I was 19 years old, for example, I had a fairly major spine surgery, and it required me to rest flat on my back, more or less, for the better part of 3 months. And I remember thinking so many times, lying there, sort of looking up, saying, what the hell am I going to do with my life now? And surgery is tough, of course, but it's not as tough as a lot of other things. Superstorm Sandy, Hurricane Katrina, January 8th, these are what now moments. Cancer diagnosis, retirement, the death of a spouse, a parent, a friend, and of course, divorce. Now, I've come to think of these experiences very much akin to the old Atari computer game Frogger. Okay? So if you don't know Frogger, well, if you don't know Frogger, that's really sad. But if you don't know Frogger, Frogger is simple. You're the frog, and your job is to navigate all these treacherous obstacles, jump on a turtle's head, and get over to the next level without becoming roadkill or maybe worse, getting eaten by an alligator. So you get the idea. Every what now moment presents obstacles and opportunities to get to the next level. These experiences challenge us to redefine ourselves, to think about where we've been, where we're going, to see the world and our place in the world in fundamentally different and new ways. And many years after my spine surgery, when I was deep into studying divorce, it finally dawned on me. My feverish interest in understanding how people put their lives back together after their marriage ends was rooted in how I dealt with my own what now moment of the surgery. Marital separation and divorce represent profound and fundamental insults to our well-being. They impact our mental health and even our physical health quite substantially. And what we do, that is how we go about the business of healing, can have a profound effect on our own lives and the lives of many, many people around us, especially if children are involved. So I'd like to spend the remainder of my time tonight trying to solve and suggest and answer the what now question for divorce. What can we do? What should we do today to start this healing process? And I want to begin by talking about something we just found out might be surprisingly bad. And I'm going to classify this in the category of what not to do now. Okay, this journal looks incredibly warm and inviting, almost like it would receive our deepest and darkest thoughts with a warm hug or embrace. But it turns out that for some people, journaling or diary writing may be among the things we really don't want to do when our marriage ends. And so we recently completed a large study in which we asked people to write about their separation experience in manners similar to the kind of diary or journal writing you do at home, in which you really express and explore your deepest emotions. And we discovered that for people who have a tendency to brood, that is for people who have a tendency to get up in their head and to go over and over these things. I can't see you, but you know who you are out there. For those people, a systematic emotional expression may be precisely the wrong thing to do. In essence, the journaling keeps these people stuck in their pain and their distress. And if in this circumstance, we're making a difficult or bad situation even worse. So in the remainder of my time now, I'm going to talk about three positive things that are critical to healing. These are the things to start doing today. First, get your sleep. Okay? Get your sleep. Many divorcing adults report considerable disturbances in their sleep. And we recently found out that for people who are struggling emotionally, especially women, the additional presence of sleep problems serves to predict increases in resting blood pressure over the coming months. In other words, compromised sleep can pose a serious health risk when our marriage ends. Now, here's the rub. We need to figure out a way to get our Z's without knocking ourselves unconscious through drugs and alcohol, right? So I put self-medication in the category of what not to do now. And not many people emphasize the importance of sleep when we face tough times. But the first thing to do is figure out a way to get some really, really satisfying rest. We have to figure out a way to sleep like this baby. Okay. The second idea is to cultivate self-compassion. Now, the phrase self-compassion is rooted in Buddhism, but I want to say you don't need to be a Buddhist to make use of this great idea. And we've defined the concept as providing compassion for yourself and your own suffering. That is, looking at yourself as you look at a dear friend, providing yourself some tenderness, coming to accept your inadequacies and your failures without getting sucked deeper and deeper into your pain. Now, psychological research studies tell us that the idea or concept is really defined by three elements or three pillars. When we are self-compassionate, we are kind to ourselves. We give ourselves a break. We stop beating on ourselves. We forgive ourselves for things we may have done and things we didn't do. Second, we're mindful. We allow our emotions to come up. We experience our emotions, and we let them pass without getting sucked deeper into our pain or wallowing in our own suffering. Finally, we cultivate a sense of common humanity. That is, instead of screaming, me, 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 all the time, and really personalizing our pain, we locate our experience as part of a larger, more universal human experience. So I'm not the first person to be divorced, and I'm not going to be the last person. Or maybe something like, into every life, a little bit of rain must fall. Now, the ultimate beauty here is that self-compassion is a teachable concept. We can learn how to be more self-compassionate, and we can use these techniques to help us get over a painful breakup. Finally, pull yourself back together again. And one of the reasons divorce is so profoundly difficult is that it represents a tremendous insult to our self-concept. We define who we are as people in large part by our relationships, who we're with. Divorce forces certain existential questions that many of us would just as soon avoid, right? Who am I? Who are my friends? How should I spend my time? What am I going to do with myself? These are profound what now questions. But unlike our man Humpty Dumpty here, we can put our self-concept back together, and this involves help from people, from other people, especially our loved ones who know us well. So a critical step in healing, then, is to reconnect to activities and with people who enhance our sense of self. And we found out, and we've seen a couple of times now, that reorganizing our sense of self, redefining who we are, seems to be the engine that drives our overall emotional healing. So if you or a loved one is facing the what now of divorce, I sincerely hope the ideas that I've talked about tonight can be helpful. If you have a tendency to get up in your head, there's some real danger in emotional journaling. Sleep like this darling baby, okay? Get your rest. Build self-compassion. Be kind to yourself. Experience your emotions. Locate your experience as part of the bigger experience. And finally, pull yourself back together again. Connect to people and activities that really enhance your sense of self. These are the ingredients for healing and ultimately, I hope, for thriving and growing. So thank you very much for having me.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we say goodbye. We say goodbye and we say that we will see each other again tomorrow. Thank you so much for having me.